Armoire makes getting dressed easy. With a clothing rental membership from Armoire, build the perfect wardrobe with brands that are high quality, unique, and recommended just for you. All you have to do is take a 5-minute style quiz and select items from your dynamic, personalized closet. The styles show up at your door in as little as 2 days. Then, when you're ready for new clothes, just swap them out for more new-to-you styles. Like many of you, my personal style has evolved over the years. But if I want to try something new, sometimes it's hard to know what pieces will work for me. Rather than going to the mall for hours and spending too much money on pieces I might not like, Armoire allows me to rent high-quality designer clothing for any occasion. I can try styles I never considered before without worrying about the store's return policy. Of course, all of this sounds great, but what's even better is that it's a woman-founded business. You benefit from finding the perfect outfits, all while supporting a business that was built by women just like us.
Right now, our listeners can give Armoire a try and get up to 50% off of their first month. That's up to $125 off. Just visit armoire.style/murderintherain. That's armoire.style/murderintherain, one word, to get up to 50% off your first month and never worry about what to wear again. Try Armoire today. With Mother's Day around the corner, are you thinking about a truly special gift for your mom or the motherly figure in your life? Let me tell you about MyLifeInABook.com. It's a unique service that turns your mom's life stories into a beautiful book. Pretty cool, right? Here's how it works. Every week, MyLifeInABook.com will send your recipient a question via email. These can be pre-written questions about, for example, your mom's life or any custom questions that you want to ask. And then she can either type her response or record her voice. And MyLifeInABook.com compiles all of her responses into a beautiful keepsake book. And guess what? They can even create an audiobook using her voice recordings. It's like preserving her voice and her stories forever. Imagine discovering stories about her youth, adventures, and the challenges she overcame. This book becomes a legacy, something you and future generations can treasure forever. Your mom's given you a lifetime of stories. This is your chance to give her a way to share them. Obviously, we love anything surrounding storytelling. It's what we do. So to be able to gift this to my mom, to not only hear her stories, but the stories of my grandparents and other family members, it will create a cherished gift for all of us to enjoy. Check out MyLifeInABook.com and use the code RAIN at checkout for 10% off. Create an unforgettable gift for your mom this Mother's Day. That's MyLifeInABook.com and use the code RAIN for 10% off today. This is Murder in the Rain, where each week Emily Rowney, Alicia Holland, and Josh McCullough tell true crime stories of the Pacific Northwest. Murder in the Rain contains graphic content. Listener discretion is advised.
Harvey Kerrignan was born in Fargo, Minnesota on May 18, 1927, to a young, single mother. As a child, he was anxious and a chronic bedwetter whose face would twitch during times of stress. He was raised Roman Catholic and had an imaginary friend named Paul. His mother was not interested in mothering and for years tried to pawn the boy off on relatives and attempted unsuccessfully to sign him over to an orphanage. At 11 years old, Harvey's mother dropped him at Mandan Reform School in North Dakota, which he described as a little prison for children. Kerrignan alleges abuse by the female guards tasked with herding these young wards. He claims they doled out punishment by smothering those with infractions against their breasts and stomachs. He claimed these things, as well as sexual abuse from both a female family member and a babysitter. And though they were never proven, Harvey believed these claims to be true, and they fueled his hatred of women. As a boy, he was thin, undersized, and bullied by older boys at Mandan, but as a man, he stood 6'2" and weighed nearly 200 pounds. The now 18-year-old Harvey needed enforced structure to maintain his own stability, so he walked into a U.S. Army recruitment office to join the Green Boys. He would later be transferred to Fort Richardson in Anchorage, Alaska, where in 1949, he would kill Laura Showalter and attempt to rape and murder Dorcas Callan. She reported the attack immediately, and Harvey was scooped up easily by police due to his hardened, super-identifiable face and hulking stature. Harvey had escaped a hanging death for Laura Showalter's murder on a technicality. His rights against self-incrimination had been violated after his arrest for the attack on Dorcas Callan. He spent time in Alcatraz after his sentence was commuted, afterward shifting between time in prison and living on the outside in almost equal measure. Kerrigan left Seattle on June 19, 1973, in his light yellow Chevy pickup, after Detectives Bauman and Homan had his Oldsmobile towed away to be processed. He'd almost thrown down with them that evening, but backed off when Detective Billy Bauman unholstered his service revolver. He eventually made his way to Minnesota, but before that, Harvey headed south. This is known because Harvey received a speeding ticket the next day in Solano County, California, the Bay Area, which would make him a suspect in a series of murders, which we'll discuss at the end of the episode. June 28, 1973, in Minneapolis, Marilys Townsend was attacked and abducted while waiting for a bus on an empty street. In her memory, there was the sound of a shoe scraping on the sidewalk behind her and then a tremendous blow to the back of her head, rendering her unconscious. Marilys woke to pain and found herself in a pickup truck driven by a, quote, huge balding man, who grabbed her hand to make Marilys touch his genitals. She pulled away and scrambled for the door handle, unlatching it. The man grabbed Marilys by the hair, but she was able to pull away and run away because her attacker had only snagged the wig she'd been wearing. She told the police the truck had a silver canopy on its top. September 9, 1973, Jerry Billings, 13, was hitchhiking in Minneapolis when a truck pulled over and let her into the cab. Jerry gave the man her destination, and as they drove, she could see they were heading in the wrong direction. When Jerry asked to be let out, the man drove on and pulled out his penis, wrestled her over to his side of the truck, and forced her to perform oral sex on him, while he raped her vaginally with the handle end of a claw hammer. When Jerry tried to raise her head, the man struck her with the hammer and, quote, her head seemed to explode, and she saw flashing lights.
Was there any... Not that someone needs an explanation, but I'm just curious why a 13-year-old was hitchhiking. Like, was she a runaway or was she houseless on the streets?
She had run away, and it wasn't specific, but she felt she couldn't go home, I imagine.
Wow.
That there was abuse,
yeah.
Something awful there. So she...
Oof, that's so scary, 13, my God.
Still conscious, she made herself as small as possible in the seat and tried not to cry because it enraged him. They drove a while longer before the man pulled into a cornfield and stopped the truck. He picked Jerry up, threw her down in the field, and attempted to rape her anally. But he couldn't maintain an erection and again raped her orally. After he ejaculated, the man let Jerry dress and drove her to Crystal, a suburb that borders Minneapolis, where he warned the girl not to tell anyone before letting her out and speeding away. It won't surprise you to hear the truck had a silver canopy.
Do you, and I'm sorry to spring this on you, do you happen to know what the technicality was that allowed him out of prison when he was on death row?
So he was brought in originally when he was arrested. He was charged with a crime and housed. And then I think the next day he was brought to the U.S. Marshal Herring to be interviewed about the murder, I believe.
Mm-hmm.
But he hadn't been in front of a judge about that crime yet. So by the time, so he was convicted and everything, and then it got to the Supreme Court, and it was a clear violation of what was called the, and I don't know if it still is, the McNabb rule.
Right.
Which protected them against that.
Right.
And, yeah.
Not that I think he should have been on death row, because I don't believe in the death penalty, but again, just hearing this 13-year-old being attacked with a hammer when he still should have been behind bars, but... The cops didn't do the right thing. Anyway.
It was Alaska, you know, frontier territory.
Yeah.
They just kind of play it loose.
Rules, schmools.
You saw the gray. It's nuts up there. Jerry did not report the crime until late October, the 29th. She had run away from home and had no one to whom she could turn. So she balled it up and stuffed the truth in that secret place where trauma lives, to smolder until she could not hold it anymore. Jerry filed the report with the Goodhue County Sheriff's Office in Red Wing, Minnesota, home to a juvenile correctional facility, Red Wing Training School, where Jerry had been sent, that was rife with the same types of abuse Harvey Kerrigan claimed he suffered while at a North Dakota reform school as a boy. I found articles regarding abuse allegations at Red Wing ranging from the years 1911 to 1988 to 2011 to 2016.
So they've been doing things about it, huh?
They've cleaned up their act. They're not letting
just
staff
anybody come get this done.
Film juvenile sex images. They don't do that. It's just unbelievable how every facility in every town, in every state,
every authority, anything,
every system is rife with pedophiles. Thank you. Harvey met Eileen Hunley, 28, in January of 1974, after her car broke down ahead of him in traffic. After Harvey tried, but couldn't get the car running, he offered Eileen and her two church friends a ride home, which they accepted. Earlier that month, Harvey had traded in his pickup for a 1971 green Chevy Caprice with black interior, which fit Harvey and the three women with room to spare. Eileen lived in Anoka, a suburb 30 miles north of Minneapolis. A member of The Way Fundamentalist Church, she was originally from Kansas and worked at a daycare center. The two began an official couple relationship that May. Eileen knew nothing of his criminal past.
She started dating the man that picked her up while she was hitchhiking?
No, she wasn't hitchhiking. They were just like in traffic.
Oh, the car. Yeah, her car died.
Yeah.
Well,
I mean, he presented a good front.
Yeah, yeah.
By being handy
and helpful.
Helpful and, yeah, and generous with his time. I mean,
that's true.
But kind of a classic, maybe like over, like a love, like not a love
yeah,
bomb,
yeah,
but
yeah,
sort of like a prowess
just
bomb.
Just masking.
Yeah. Oh, yeah.
Yeah, yeah, prowess bomb. I like that.
Thank you. A body was found in Olathe, Kansas on June 19th, 1974. It was later discovered that Harvey and Eileen were staying at a family home 80 miles away from where the body was found. That weekend, he left the home several times for unexplained reasons and was away for hours each time. In July, the relationship between Eileen and Harvey went bad. Harvey had started drinking heavily, which stoked his temper. He would become enraged anytime she voiced her worries. Eileen broke it off with Harvey, saying she hoped they would maintain a friendship. She was seen in her home on Saturday, August 10th, but she failed to attend church, work, and a prayer meeting the next day. None of her family or friends heard a thing from her. The same day, or shortly after, Eileen's co-workers were creeped out and alarmed when Harvey dropped by to collect her paycheck. They refused his request, even though he said Eileen had sent him, as she was indisposed.
Just the idea of, because she was with friends, she probably wasn't a victim the first time they met. Like, that might have been the only reason why, was because she had the two ladies with her.
I never thought about that. Absolutely, yeah.
And then he's like, yeah, might as well have a girlfriend for a while.
Yeah,
oh, we're breaking up. I'm done. My gosh. And that's, I feel like that's kind of unusual too, because people tend to keep the facade, serial killers tend to keep the facade of, here's my happy, normal family, here's my girlfriend or my wife, and they are off limits and everyone else is the target. So I feel like you don't often hear someone being like, well, and then the girlfriend dumped me, so.
Harvey's control over his impulses seems to have left him in the wake of Eileen's disappearance. On September 8th, friends Lisa King, 16, and June Lynch, who would turn 17 the next day, were hitchhiking outside of the alternative school they attended, the Work Opportunity Center, and soon climbed into the green Chevy Caprice that pulled over for them. The driver was over 40 and balding and had a face like a rough sculpture of a ghoul. It was Harvey, and he offered the girls $25 to help him gas up and drive a stalled-out car of his back to Minneapolis from Mora, 70 miles north. Leary, yet piqued by the offer of cash, they agreed. But before they reached Mora, Harvey turned off the highway into a wooded area, where he stopped the truck, grabbed a gas can, a screwdriver, and a hammer, and had June follow him into the trees. June had just begun weighing the plausibility of it being a reasonable spot for a truck to be parked when Harvey spun toward her with something raised in his fist. Lisa heard June scream from the truck and ran in the direction she'd seen the pair walk. She found June on the ground with blood pouring from her head. Harvey was gone. Lisa ran for help and found some at a nearby farmhouse. A deputy sheriff soon arrived and rushed the teenagers to a hospital, where ER staff found 7 hammer strikes on June's head. She survived and recovered from her wounds and a severe concussion through weeks of dizzy spells and headaches.
There's something extra disturbing about the fact that he is like, that he's utilizing his knowledge of human psychology from his experiences to know how willing people are to help with stuff or how willing people are to just get in your car. Like, oh, I know I can just go find a hitchhiker because they need a ride and they think I'm being nice.
Yeah, I was reading one of the articles and they mentioned Ed Kemper, who admitted to trying different personalities over time to see if he would joke a little more or be more serious, how people would respond once they got in the car. I'm surprised, actually, thinking about him not killing Eileen Hunley right away. He wouldn't kill 3 people right away. Why wouldn't he, you know?
Yeah, maybe he just felt intimidated by that many people. I mean, that's a lot of people.
Oh, you know what? Honestly, he was raised Catholic, and he pretended to be a Catholic, and he was way into the Bible.
Oh.
So there may have been, I wonder if there was some emotional
tug. Some
sort of
church lady aspect.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Where he did have some limited, briefly lasting respect for her as a person. It was late morning on September 14th, and student nurse Gwen Burton's blue Ford was parked at Chicago and Lake Streets in Minneapolis. The gosh darn engine wouldn't turn over, so, frustrated, she got out and popped the hood. While she was looking down at the engine, a Chevy Caprice stopped, and Harvey got out wearing mechanic-style green work clothes, like he always did. He asked what's the problem, and after Gwen explained, he said he could fix it, but they'd have to run to his place for some tools. He didn't care that she couldn't pay, and silently shut her hood, rolled up the windows, and led Gwen to his car's passenger side by the elbow. She tried to pull away, but Harvey commanded her to get in a way that terrified the 19-year-old. The street was empty of pedestrians, and Harvey forced her into the car, driving southwest out of the city into rural Carver County. The attack matched very closely the attack and rape of Jerry Billings, the forced oral rape, and the hammer forced inside Gwen's vagina, which tore her hymen. He repeatedly choked her unconscious and would slap her across the face when she cried. Gwen asked if he was going to kill her, and Harvey replied that she shouldn't say such things because they might give him ideas. Harvey punched Gwen twice in the stomach, and as she bent over with the wind knocked out of her, he brought his hammer down on her head. Gwen woke up in a gully, soaked in a pool of her own blood. Her hair was matted and dried crisp with it, and her head felt split all the way through. She could not make her body walk, so she dragged herself up the gully and clawed her way out and into a silent alfalfa field. It took her 3 tries and 3.5 hours to achieve her goal. Through the pain and blood, Gwen could see a road far off and began to crawl across the field on her stomach. After a very long time, she reached the side of the road, but was too weak to shout for help as cars and tractors passed by unaware. A few cars did slow for her, though. They would stare, return her wave, and then drive on. As one tractor neared, Gwen called out again, and this time she heard the motor stop and saw a farm boy approaching her on fast feet. She survived, but was partially paralyzed in her right arm and leg for months, had ongoing issues with her memory, and had difficulty speaking when she was tired. She had to drop out of nursing school and never returned. On September 17th, a body was found in Sherburne County, an area around 42 miles northwest of Minneapolis. The female had been dead a minimum of 2 weeks, bludgeoned to death with a claw hammer, and, quote, there was a tree branch. The killer had jammed into the vagina. On September 18th, Harvey pulled the same $25 to drive the stalled car ruse on Sally Versoy he worked on Lisa King and June Lynch 10 days earlier. She agreed, but said they had to take her friend Diana Flynn with, so they picked the 17-year-old up at school, the same work opportunity center where Harvey had picked up students Lisa in June. Harvey drove north to a deserted area, stopped the car, and asked Lisa and June if given a choice, would they rather be raped or killed? Quote, both responded instantly, we'd rather be killed. Harvey registered this with a grunt and drove on. When Diane asked how much further it would be to their destination, Harvey's arm flew like a spring trap, backhanding her in the face, cutting her lip and chipping two of her teeth. When Harvey pulled into a gas station in St. Francis, nearly 40 miles north of Minneapolis, June and Diane were able to escape the vehicle and found safety from Harvey inside the station. Harvey drove off, and the young woman reported the incident as soon as they returned to the city. Kathy Schultz, an 18-year-old student at Washburn High School, also took night classes at the Work Opportunity Center in Minneapolis. On the morning of September 20th, she planned to stop by the center to take care of a quick errand. This was the place, probably one of many, which Harvey Kerrigan would cruise outside of like a shark. He had already assaulted, raped, and beaten at least three of the school students. Kathy Schultz's brother was the last of her family to see her, giving her a quick good morning and goodbye, and expecting to see her later that afternoon. When night fell and Kathy had not returned home, her family called all of her friends, but no one had seen her. In a field of tall grass and bundled corn shocks 50-ish miles north of Minneapolis, in Ashanti County, two pheasant hunters froze when they realized the shape at their feet was the body of a woman. It had no face. Blunt object trauma had crushed the features, and its hair was soaked red from all the blood. Quote, her skull was imploded. The body was identified as Kathy Schultz. The body found in Sherburne County back on September 17th was a Caucasian female, badly decomposed. Detectives investigating the attack on Gwen Burton heard from multiple acquaintances about Harvey's girlfriend, Eileen, whom no one had seen in 5 weeks. After obtaining a search warrant and combing through her home, detectives found no physical evidence of violence and nothing seemed out of place. But among the items they did collect was a dentist bill addressed to Eileen. The Kansas City-located dentist was contacted and sent the records on file to the Hennepin County Medical Examiner's Office. Upon comparison, quote, the alignment and dental work were identical. The body was that of Eileen Hunley. There were few discrepancies among the descriptions of Harvey given by the young women he attacked, like differing estimates regarding his height. But the details that matched did so like a bunch of keys sliding into a bunch of locks. He was terribly strong, always clad in green work clothes, and in the lead-up to each attack, continuously barked threats and obscene language at his captives through camel cigarette smoke. And obviously, all of the survivors' statements had extremely accurate details regarding Harvey's dead eyes in his huge mutton-chop sideburn-framed boogeyman face. The suspect was still unknown to authorities. Detectives from Hennepin County Sheriff's Office, Ashanti County, and the Minneapolis Police Department conducted a joint meeting regarding the crimes. Comparing cases, they'd come to the Detective 101 conclusion that the crimes were related. And there was essentially no physical evidence, except for a plaster cast of a tire tread found in the field where Kathy Schultz's body was found. The room of detectives agreed that their suspect lived in Minneapolis, likely near to the Work Opportunity Center, though they had no idea of Harvey, or that his given address was just over 2 miles away from the center. A memo containing descriptions of the green caprice and the physical description of their unsub was distributed to all patrol officers within 100 miles of Minneapolis.
What's an unsub?
Unknown subject.
Ah.
The next day, September 24th, a pair of officers on patrol observed a hideous man in green work clothes walk across a parking lot and climb into a green Chevy Caprice. Harvey was pulled over and asked for ID. The officers noted the interior matched the memo's description, black. Harvey began pouring sweat, and his face, as always, betrayed him and began twitching around his eye and forehead. He was arrested, and his bail was set at $50,000. They pulled him over. They asked him who he was. he matched enough that they took him downtown and started asking him about.
So he was simply pulled over.
Yeah, the bulletin was released, and just two random patrol officers just happened to see him and were like, he looks exactly like it. He's getting into the exact same car. He was suspicious when they confronted him, and then they took him down. Jerry Billings was taken to a police garage to identify Kerrigan's pickup. Even though it had been over a year, Jerry peered inside and instantly recognized the black interior, the bucket seats, and the board covering the space between them. The plaster cast of the tire tread matched the make and model of tires listed on a receipt found in Harvey's belongings, dated August 12, 1974. Investigators combing through the warranted locations discovered several maps. The range of the maps spread across the western states, through the Midwest, and north to Canada, covered with nearly 200 areas marked with red circles. Quote, some of the circles yielded nothing, indicating points where Harvey had applied for jobs or purchased vehicles, but others seemed to link him with a string of unsolved homicides and other crimes involving women. One such cryptic circle coincided with the discovery of a murdered girl in Medora, North Dakota, in April 1973. Yet another had been drawn around the very intersection in Vancouver where a woman, waiting for the city bus, had been assaulted from behind and beaten with a hammer. There was another marking indicating the Tualatin Reservation where Kathy Miller's body was found, as well as a red circle around Whidbey Island where the body of Laura Brock was discovered in September of 1972. But there were also circles that led down blind alleys, as happened with sheriff's deputies in Yakima County, Washington, who investigated the eight red circles covering their area, none of which materialized into a case. It would never be known how many Kerrigan had hurt, raped, and killed, but he was suspected of as many as 180 attacks on women from Seattle to Minneapolis. Jeez. Lisa King, June Lynch, Diane Flynn, and Sally Versoy identified Harvey Kerrigan in a police lineup. From a bed in ICU, Gwen Burton indicated Harvey's photo among a laydown of 12 mugshots. February 19, 1975, Harvey was tried for the attempted murder and sodomy of Gwen Burton. During the trial, he was described by his jailers as a, quote, model prisoner, a gentleman, in fact, which may have been due to the leg irons and handcuffs with which he was always constrained in court. On February 24th, Gwen Burton, still partially paralyzed from the injuries Harvey inflicted upon her, testified, quote, I was crying the whole time. He told me to shut up. He told me he wanted to see me suffer. When questioned on the stand, Harvey said his reason for trying to kill Gwen was that God told him to, a recurring bit Harvey would often employ to explain away the acts his mind and his hands carried out. His defense attorney, Russell Kruger, later said, quote, he could quote the Bible as good as any minister that I've ever heard, and he once replied to Harvey's vast knowledge of the good book that the devil was also quite capable of quoting scripture.
Murder in the Rain, we love a good family mystery and we love a good video game. And now that we have the convenience of holding computers in our hands, we know the absolute joy of finding the perfect video game. Just like most of us, I like to wind down at night with some gameplay on my phone, usually while waiting for ads to finish on my streamer service, and June's Journey is a perfect match. Step into the 1920s in the role of June Parker, who is searching for hidden clues to uncover the mystery of her sister's murder. You can use your keen observation skills to quickly uncover key pieces of information that lead to each chapter of the game. And of course, there's a scandalous hidden family secret to uncover. It has it all. Mystery, danger, romance. Where will each new chapter take you? Now, this isn't any old mystery game. You get to customize your very own estate island by decorating and building gardens and buildings. You can even chat and play with or against other players by joining a detective club.
I'm pretty early into the game, but there is already so much to enjoy. The setting of the 1920s is fun and really beautifully done. The mystery is exciting, like when a character fell through a secret trap door. I like playing a game to relax, but to also stimulate my mind. It's not a difficult game, but you have to be paying attention and moving fast to find objects in time to multiply your score. June's journey also features puzzling elements, like a torn-up photograph that I had to reassemble. It's cool!
Can you crack the case? Download June's Journey for free today on iOS and Android.
In late April 1975, Harvey was tried for the physical assault and sexual abuses inflicted against Jerry Billings. Jerry testified that she hadn't initially reported the crime for weeks because she had run away from home and thought she'd be arrested if she sought help from the police. Gwen, June, Sally, Diane, and Marilis also testified, recalling their nearly deadly run-ins with Kerrigan to the court. Harvey was found guilty on all counts in both cases, and he was sentenced to 30 years in each case for his crimes against Jerry Billings and Gwen Burton. On February 9, 1976, Harvey waived his rights in court and admitted he had picked up Kathy Schultz hitchhiking back in September 1974 and then left her body in the field where she was later discovered by hunters. Presiding District Judge Robert Backe asked Kerrigan if a hammer was used in the murder. Harvey said no and described it as similar to a climbing or trenching tool, I think maybe something with a pick end. Before handing down a 40-year sentence for the murder, Judge Backe addressed Kerrigan. Quote, "Your crimes are so gross that there is no point in commenting on them." Kerrigan interrupted at that point and told the judge, "Don't comment on them then." Harvey had amassed 100 years of prison time, but the state of Minnesota, by law, would only demand a maximum of 40 years served.
Why?
And just to make you scream, the sentences would run concurrently, and he would be eligible for parole in only 17 years.
I literally almost joked and said, oh, wow, I can't believe they gave him a fairly reasonable sentence. Let me guess, they're going to be concurrent? I almost said that as a joke, but I should have known. What is this law? Why does it? I'm sorry. What law do you speak of? Why would he only get that amount of time and not the sentence that he was given by a judge for the things that he did?
I don't know the law, but there is one.
And of course there is.
Feeling lucky, Harvey decided to roll the dice and go to trial for the murder of Eileen Hunley. And his gamble paid off. For the state.
Hey!
Harvey was convicted of first-degree murder and sentenced to life in prison on June 24th, 1976.
I love when arrogance bites them in the ass.
Harvey appealed, and 2 years later, the Minnesota Supreme Court said, nah, and upheld the conviction.
Oh my God, really?
Yep.
Oh, I'm waiting for the other shoe to drop. Be like, oh, actually, another technicality.
Kerrigan would die in prison. Author Anne Rule interviewed Seattle detectives Billy Bauman and Dwayne Homan while doing research for her book, The Want Ad Killer, which I highly recommend, and it's available used on ThriftBooks for under $5. This is not an advertisement. Detective Homan commented, quote, "It's a terrible thing to say, but I almost wish that Harvey had pulled that hammer on us when we went out to tow his car away that day in 1973. If we'd had to kill him then, think of the young woman who would have lived. If it had ended that day, none of the Minnesota crimes would have ever happened."
I get what he's saying by that. I mean, I don't condone police violence, but yeah, that'd be great to save those women. But it's also like, maybe you should be more upset with your buddies that didn't do their job right the first time that led to the technicality. And then you wouldn't have to, like, wish that you shot the guy in a field.
And he did say that he never wanted to shoot anybody ever.
Oh, yeah. I don't think he's like gun happy. I get what he's saying by that. But it's also like, maybe instead of wishing this guy had gone after you, you could wish that like the thing you worked in was more like properly managed and people followed the law. Just saying.
Though the case lay unsolved in police archives, Detective Homan dug through them and pulled out the Kathy Miller case file. He flipped it open and inside wrote, "January 31st, 1983. This case is closed. Exceptional. The killer of Catherine Sue Miller is presently incarcerated in the Minnesota State Prison."
And I'm sorry, which gal was that?
She was the the in part one, it was Laura Brock was first killed on Whidbey Island. And then 8 months later, I believe, it was when Catherine Sue Miller, who was 15, she was the one whose books were found in the parking lot.
Right.
She was going to meet him outside of the Sears, all that.
Yeah, she was the one doing the job interview.
Yes, exactly. Okay. A couple paragraphs ago, I said Harvey Kerrigan would die in prison, but not that he has died. Kerrigan is still alive and remains incarcerated. He is 95 years old and still locked away at the Minnesota Correctional Facility Stillwater in Bayport, Minnesota. He still looks very much the mean old bastard. In a more recent prison mugshot, he has traded out the mutton chops for a biker mustache, but his eyes are the same, cold and reflecting nothing.
Wow. That's old for prison. That's old for everyday life.
That's like the oldest man on earth as far as prisoners go, I feel.
That's very old.
Incredibly old.
Especially for how long he's been in prison.
And honestly, for how large of a person he is. I feel like gigantic people, like big people don't live forever. But he's fueled by, you know, hate. And I'm sure that he also gets satisfaction from still being alive.
Oh, yeah.
And for those families that are affected by what he did. To say that I'm still here and they're still not.
It did. I mean, I know I kind of cheered earlier. That was my initial reaction to hearing that he was going to die behind bars. But yeah, my feelings totally changed when you said he's still alive, because it's like Richard Gilmore, the guy who's being let out in Oregon from Emily's case. He's being released on December 16th.
As a level one sex offender.
As a level one sex offender. At least a three if released at all.
He's a violent sexual predator.
And so just that thought, even though he's 94, even though he will die behind bars. 95, I apologize. So it's like he's already been released before on something, you know, it's like the possibility of that, of this person.
And I have a couple of other things that I wanted to talk about that I didn't get to.
I'm just shocked. I guess with there being a book about it, it's a well-known case, but I didn't know this case. I don't know this guy. And you hear so often about, Craigslist, the Craigslist killer, can you believe it? And it's like, this stuff has been going on since the invention of any kind of public forum, bulletin boards and newspapers and...
Belle Gunness?
Yeah.
Sending away for husbands?
Yeah. So it's just shocking to not hear, but I don't know if it's that people thought he was less because people survived or something, you know, how we so often hear that, but...
At the beginning of the episode, I mentioned Harvey getting a speeding ticket in Solano County in California, like the Bay Area. And this was on June 20th, 1973. There's a series of murders called the Santa Rosa Hitchhiker Murders that he was suspected of committing.
Oh.
Yeah, because he drove all the time. His first wife, whose name is Sheila, I believe, I think they were married in 1969 and it fell apart very quickly, said that he would often drive at night, all night, come home. And like with Eileen in Kansas, when they were at that home and that body was found, he'd be gone all night and would never explain what it was.
Oh, so
he drove.
It's believed this has been going on a very long time.
Yeah, and police said that he had clocked 200,000 miles on his truck.
Oh, that's right.
From 1972 to the time that he was taken, which is just I don't know how you could do it.
That's
it's
a lot.
So between February 1972 and December 1973, this is a quote here, the bodies of seven girls and young women were found in rural Santa Rosa, buried or dumped along steep embankments or in creek beds. All were found nude. Some had been raped, strangled, or hogtied.
So very possible, even probable, that it was him.
Yeah, definitely. At least some of them. I know that there were a couple that didn't match, but there were, because it was like, strangling. One had been poisoned, but they were all dumped in the same way.
Hmm.
The case, it's still unsolved, and the Sonoma County Sheriff's Department, which is the investigating department, has looked into hundreds of suspects, and some of them are very high profile, like Ted Bundy, Zodiac Killer, and Harvey. Because the ticket that he received, there was one in June, I think, of 73. It was just right in the window. And there were eight other tickets, I think, he received in that window. But he could never be tied to the crimes. But I was wrapping up the episode this morning, doing a little more research to kind of get a little more clarity on the Hitchhiker Murder series. And I found an article from February of this year there was a DNA match to CODIS, you know, the FBI database of whatever, DNA samples. And there was a match to a man named Jack Boken, and it was connected to the murder of a woman named Michelle Veal in Union City, California, that happened in 1996.
Oh.
And they never solved it. It laid cold for a long time. But there was a new detective who joined the Violent Crimes Investigation Unit, which covered these cold cases. And he was just going through one of the cases. He just wanted to just kind of crack open a cold case and look at it and see what he could do.
Right.
And it happened to be Michelle Veal's. And they found a scraping that was never tested of Michelle Veal's hand that might have had DNA. So like a nail scraping.
Yeah.
So they tested it. Comes back to this guy named Jack Boken, who is already in prison. And he actually died in 2021 from pneumonia. He was 78.
Mm.
And he was in prison serving a 231-year sentence for convictions on 19 felony counts from October of 2000 for kidnapping and sexually assaulting three women and for trying to murder one of them.
Wow.
This is a quote here. Jack Boken was not just a San Francisco serial rapist. He held these women in the basement of homes while his family was at home and was striking these women on the back of the head with a hammer. So they matched. So those killings, the Santa Rosa hitchhiker murders.
Oh,
they
were similar.
And also Michelle Veal's body, I don't know if I said that, was also dumped on the side of the road. Also, looking into his background, they found that this Jack Boken's parents had a home near Santa Rosa during the time of those murders.
Wow.
I know that now that they've had that match and that now that those crimes have those similarities, they're going back and they're looking at all of them all over again.
Hmm.
And there may be, yeah. So what I think is that there's those murders and probably many, many others that just overlap between, I mean, at least
Definitely.
Those two and probably more like 20 yeah. serial killers or something like that.
Yeah.
I'm hoping there's an update. I'm hoping they can at least close the case on that one, you know, or at least
yeah.
tie him definitively, you know?
Mm-hmm.
But yeah, nice. He died of pneumonia last year, so.
Well, one less monster.
At least he's dead.
So in all, how many victims, either surviving or not, do they think Harvey had?
They said, you know, as many as 180. That's the big number. And it may even be more. I mean, a man like that could run unchecked and he could have killed someone literally every night of his life for mm-hmm. years and no one would have ever noticed.
Yeah.
Because he was... Well, I mean, except for the sweating and twitching and looking the way he did, he was pretty good at holding it together.
Yeah.
And he was successful. His gas station sold the most gas in town.
Oh, and he's a local businessman. He's not, what do you...
He's a little rough around the edges. He gets a little angry. He'll pick up a truck and slam it down on the ground somehow.
But he's not gonna... Yeah. Well, I look forward to the day you can tell us that he is no longer amongst us.
Thank you. There was another tangent, a quick
one. Oh, yes.
So when Harvey was on trial, I think the first trial he went to, which was the Gwen Burton attack. I'm not sure exactly. Maybe mm-hmm. Jerry Billings. In the middle of all of that, the trial and everything, there was an unidentified woman called into the FBI to talk about a sketch she'd seen on an FBI bulletin regarding a kidnapping. And it was the kidnapping of, this is in Minneapolis, of a woman named Virginia Piper, who was married to an investment banker who was very well known. One day, two masked men broke into the house. They were going to steal their son or kidnap their son, Bobby, but instead she was home. So they took Virginia and then sent a ransom letter to the husband, Harry, for $1 million. He paid it. And then 2 days later, they received a call telling them where to get her. And they went to the state park. And she was there tied to a tree. I'm sorry, chained to a tree. But she was alive. She wasn't hurt. She was just wet and cold and hungry.
Wow. You don't often hear about that.
Ever.
Out.
Which, yeah, that was the first part of the story that was really, really novel, is that they didn't kill her. So the sketch the woman saw was of a possibility for one of the two kidnappers of Virginia Piper.
Mm.
And that person looked like someone that was associated with Harvey Kerrigan.
Oh.
So, and then in their investigation, police found that he has two brothers, two half-brothers, Clint and Bernard, I believe, who I'm imagining might be the person that that woman saw.
Oh.
Because I'm just guessing they kind of have a similar look to them.
Right.
And so that identification led to them finding Harvey.
So the woman was kidnapped and then they had a sketch of, did she?
This wasn't the woman that was kidnapped that said it. So it was some woman saw this sketch in this bulletin. I thought it looked like someone, a friend of Harvey Kerrigan's or maybe his brother, contacted the FBI. The FBI investigate Harvey and they're like, hey, the FBI assembled a voice lineup and took it to Virginia Piper. They play it for her and they're like, and she's like, that is one of the guys that kidnapped me. And so the FBI talks to Kerrigan, he denies it. And as far as the ransom goes, $1 million was collected by the kidnappers, but only twice were they used, was any of the money used. So it was in 1972 and 1974 in Minneapolis and just outside of Minneapolis, money was passed just like in a store or whatever, and then found by the FBI. But after that, it never happened again. Well, Harvey Kerrigan was in prison from 1974 till today.
Oh, and so if he had that money, it's just sitting somewhere.
I think it's just stashed, sitting somewhere.
And buried, hidden.
Because I don't think he'd be like, hey, half brother, here's this money. I don't think he would do that.
Right.
Oh, and the state park where they found Virginia Piper tied up to the tree was across the road from a farm in near Duluth where Harvey lived as a kid for a brief time.
Oh my gosh. I know that's all circumstantial, but when like all of these crime scenes are within like a couple of miles of you, like.
And the last part of it was that the 20s that were used in these two parts. So it was one in southern Minnesota and then another in Brooklyn Park, which is near Minneapolis. There were maps, some of the maps that they found of Harvey with the red circles.
Right.
There were two circles that matched on a Minnesota map to those spots. Yeah. So it was, I don't know if it was exact location or just the area.
Right.
But again, it's like another.
Wow.
There's so many links. And this is all in the middle of his trial for the other crimes that he committed.
Right.
And it was like a quick tangent of only like a couple of days, but it was, yeah. It's just strange that his presence was felt in other places like that. That he may have had a vast criminal career. I know that he went to prison with his brother, I think, for robbery and theft and things like that.
So. Yeah, his MO is scary because there is one, but there also is a variety of them.
Yeah.
So it's like whatever he feels like doing that day.
Yeah, and he loved all types of crime.
Wow.
Yeah.
Good riddance.
So that was the other tangent, and that's really it. Yeah, I worked on this for a long time. I started it in August before I had my surgery, and
just
finished it this morning.
You started it with your old heart, finished it with the new.
It's just the wrong texture for that area. Hi, everybody. This is Josh.
You hesitated. It's going to get cold.
Yeah, it
will.
Yeah, it will.
You do know it.
Well, the weather outside is unchanging. It's quite deranging.
Oh. Sell my furniture. I'm rearranging.
What? Brian Williams style.
Oh.
Ooh. He watched his daughter get her butt eaten out.
I watched his daughter get her butt eaten out a couple times. Thanks,
Brian. We talked about that like in an interview or something, and I hated it.
That's my kind of tangent right there. We touched on so many things at once. It was fantastic. We're pop culture... knowers.
Sometimes. Unless it's popular music or
welcome to our new
TikTok.
Our new podcast, The Pop Culture Knowers.
Sometimes.
Sometimes. Sometimes.
Hey guys, Emily isn't here today, so it's just us elderly folks that aren't on TikTok.
We watched some sort of music award and didn't know anyone.
How about that Jack Harlow with that chicken
sandwich?
That chicken meal.
A very important announcement to make. I'm a fool. My little dummy. Stupid eyes won't do it. My little stupid brain won't read them. My little mouth won't form the words. Filed the report with the Goodhue County Sheriff's Office.
Goodhue County Sheriff's Office? I did.
No, you didn't. You've never sounded like that.
Too spicy. Cut it out. Uncle Joey style. In a theater.
What?
Dave Coulier.
It took me a second to connect those dots.
I counted them.
But then I remembered the cross-eyed bear. In a theater. I'm like, there's no way Dave Coulier has ever performed in a theater.
He did, in a way. Allegedly. And not theater.
Oh, no, we've lost it.
No, it's good. I have energy now. I'm like, laugh. I'm able to laugh again.
Oh, I can laugh again. I can smell again. I can fart again. In a theater.
Ooh, that was a jagged little pill. Ouch. Alan Thicke dated a teenager.
Of course he did.
Christy Swanson, I believe.
Christy Swanson, you say?
And she was like...
That's right. She was super young.
Or 15. That's right. Or
Buffy herself. The real Buffy.
She is my Buffy. I saw that in the goddamn theater with my mommy. And it was great. Anne Rice was pissed originally when Tom Cruise was cast because she wanted Rutger Hauer.
That would have been horrible.
Rutger Hauer and Cher or Brad Pitt?
The original cast of Interview with the Vampire is Rutger Hauer and Cher.
Yeah.
Wow.
Fun fact.
That would have been really bad.
I've got legs. And they end in weird feet. Oh, no.
Did you throw up a little bit?
A little bit.
Oh.
That was my peanut butter and jelly and mocha.
Ooh.
So it wasn't the worst thing in the world, but I wouldn't want a cup of it.
Oh, no. All That's right. Like the I wouldn't kick it out of bed.
I wouldn't want a cup of it.
Yeah.
I wouldn't kick it out of bed for throwing up in my mouth. Oh shit. Piper Perabo. Okay, so now I don't know what I said.
Murder in the Rain is a Cascade Media production, written and hosted by Emily Rowney, Alicia Holland, and Josh McCullough, edited by Josh McCullough. You can always contact us at murderintherain@gmail.com or through our website, murderintherain.com. If you just can't get enough of Murder in the Rain, for as little as $5 a month, you'll have exclusive access to bonus episodes at patreon.com. You can find us on all of the socials, and for more true crime, follow @M_MurderInTheRain on TikTok, and you can also listen to Alicia and Josh on their other show, Always Be My Sisters. And suck my balls.